Liron Hirschkorn here, host of the E-Commerce Mindset Podcast. I just finished recording a conversation with Paul Raffleson, who is an attorney who has been advocating on behalf of Amazon sellers for the last several years, fighting Amazon and the government on sales tax issues on behalf of sellers. Recently this year, suing Kentucky for price gouging laws and trying to apply state laws where Amazon can't control the states where products are being sold, and is really an advocate on behalf of Amazon sellers. He's personally given me some great advice over the last year in, you know, legal issues that you know, I've had to face in legal agreements, and I find is really an advocate for sellers. And when you have him on your side, I think it's really can be really beneficial to whatever legal issue you may be facing. So I hope you enjoyed this interview. We kind of cover what are the legal issues that Amazon or sellers are facing today, from the new rule coming up where your address is going to be visible, to talking about, you know, antitrust laws against, you know, Amazon that are happening now, or the antitrust hearing that's happening, to the price gouging and the sales tax issue. So I think you'll just find this interesting as to what the current legal environment looks like for Amazon sellers. Hope you enjoy this interview with Paul Raffleson. The show is sponsored by IncrementumDigital.com, which is my Amazon sponsored ads agency, where we're helping sellers grow their sales on Amazon using Amazon advertising, using DSP, using video ads, using sponsored display, and all the tools in the arsenal that can help you grow your business. Sponsored display, product targeting ads, we've seen consistently an ACoS under 10% for these ad types, and a lot of success with video ads. You can reach out to us at IncrementumDigital.com, or my email, Liron@IncrementumDigital, is also in the show notes. Enjoy this interview with Paul Raffleson. I'm excited to have Paul Raffleson with us on the show today. Paul Raffleson is an attorney that's been around the Amazon seller space for several years, at least all the time that I've been around. I've consistently seen Paul being on the front end of all issues, legal issues that are affecting sellers, as well as how they interact with Amazon. He's been on the forefront of the sales tax issue and getting Amazon and the government and legislation kind of pushed to help sellers dealing with Amazon most recently. And that's as part of leading the way as part of OMG, Online Merchants Guild, which is an organization that's designed to be an advocate for e-commerce and Amazon sellers. And then earlier this year, I saw Paul win a case where he went against Kentucky in going after sellers for price gouging on Amazon and working with sellers there. So I'm really excited to have Paul on to talk about the issues, the current legal issues that are affecting sellers. Thanks so much for coming on, Paul.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. This is exciting to, you know, likewise, I you know, known you for some time, but I've seen you around a lot, you know, even before we've I've gotten to know you more over the last few years, so very equally exciting for me to be on and chat with you and your audience. So
thank you. So how did you get into working with Amazon sellers? Initially, how does a lawyer, you know, who's not kind of in that world, get into suddenly being thrust into, you know, fighting against, you know, some of the biggest, you know, companies in the world, you know, on legal issues?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. It's changed a lot of my belief and sort of faith and philosophy of fate, even just how, you know, life comes together in a certain way to put you in a position to do something that's truly different and, you know, more extraordinary than what you normally would be thinking of yourself as doing. You know, I, you know, tell people sort of jokingly, like, if you put my name in Google, you'll find me in a lot of news articles and major publications, right? I mean, that's not a trajectory that I was ever intending or seeking in my life. So, you know, I started in this space about 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, exactly. Prior to that, I had spent my life was a corporate lawyer doing a lot of tax litigation for large companies working in-house. I was at Microsoft, I was at Walmart, I was at GE, I was at a firm before I was at any of those places. So, I'm doing this sort of corporate tax law thing and, working on interesting things, fighting the government, working on major deals, just kind of touching on all sorts of areas of law, because it's kind of a weird thing about taxes. People think about tax law as like H&R Block and doing your taxes, and that's something that I have an accountant too. I don't do my own taxes, but the law is very different. The law is very factual. So to be a tax lawyer, you kind of have to know a lot about a lot of different things, because the facts are what drive how something is taxed. So if you don't know the facts around a certain scenario, around a certain business practice, then you really can't argue it very well. And we saw that with sales tax. But so there I was. And to give you a little bit of my background, prior, a long time ago when I was in law school, so we're talking over 17 years ago, I graduated in 05, but when I was in school, 17, 18 years ago, I started to sell online to make money. This is how I was paying for school. I was selling, I was doing retail arbitrage. I was doing mostly DVD flipping. I was buying a lot of DVDs. I started on a Black Friday. And I've been flipping stuff. And then just from there, flipping what I can find at the discount rack and Walmarts and stuff. And then I was sustaining a living. I was making, good money, but this is before FBA. And I never really thought that this could be a living, if this is something you could scale. I mean, I'm paying for law school, I'm paying for my living expenses, I'm not having to take on student debt. This is great. But I'm not thinking like, okay, people are going to be making so much money in this Amazon thing, right? And actually, when I first started, it wasn't even Amazon. It was half.com was my biggest channel. And Amazon sort of grew in my third year of law school. I think my Amazon side grew to be more than everything else, but there was still no FBA for years until years later. And then coincidentally, when I moved to Seattle years later and worked for Microsoft, my wife ended up getting a job with Amazon and the seller performance team. And my coworkers at Microsoft, I was in my mid-20s. My coworkers at Microsoft, much older families, different priorities, whereas the Amazon crew, the seller performance team, were kind of more our age. And so I would tend to go out with the Amazon crew, and the conversation over drinks would be often about work, which I was fascinated by. So I had this infinite insight into how things were working on the inside, seller performance, as sort of a hobby seller, because I would still sell and just for sport, when I had time. And so, I've got all this sort of knowledge about Amazon. And then around 3 years ago, I was asked to do a blog post for an Amazon consultant about sales tax. All of a sudden, it came to me, and it was one of my wife's coworkers, former coworkers, came to me and said, I've got all these clients who are getting told they need to, file in all these states and pay all these back taxes. I know you do this for a living. This is part of what you do. Can you chime in? And what started as a blog post became a full-fledged practice. So, it wasn't intentional that I was thinking, okay, this is me now becoming an Amazon attorney, or an attorney for Amazon sellers or merchants, or an advocate for merchants. It was just me doing a blog post saying, wow, the states have this wrong. The states are saying you guys are all on the hook. And I'm like, not really, because you're not really retailers. And again, drawing from my knowledge of being an Amazon seller, like knowing how the system works and knowing how FBA works and all those things, even though I didn't do FBA, I knew it. I knew how it worked, and I've
Meaning
done it since.
the argument being that Amazon is actually the one that has the customer data. Amazon is the one that's charging their credit card and has their credit card information, and Amazon is the actual retailer, not the seller.
Yeah, or is the sell right? Exactly, not the merchant, right?
Not the merchant.
But the merchant is you are selling, but it's more of a consignment wholesale relationship, right? So exactly, it was this state's saying you owe all this tax, but I'm like, that's not really your store. You're not really the retailer here, and it sort of became curious to me, and sort of learned a lot about just how bad state politics can be. But, you know, the states were clearly choosing favorites here. They were appeasing Amazon. They didn't want to mess with Amazon. So they thought, hey, let's go after these small businesses instead. And, you know, so exactly. So, you know, everybody's saying, oh, you're guilty. Sign up for our sales tax, sign up in 50 states. I'm like, there's no way even $1 million seller can really afford to handle the 50 state tax burden. You know, it's what's coming to them. Between the sales tax and then there was income tax and there was, you know, so yeah, so I sort of wrote a blog post about how, you know, you guys really aren't retailers. There's also no nexus. This whole idea of this nexus thing based on FBA was complete bogus nonsense. It doesn't fly in any other court setting.
So nexus being like you're holding inventory in the state, but again, Amazon controls where that inventory is, not you.
Exactly.
That's kind of the argument.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's more about right. They were sort of saying that your nexus, whether you're subject to the jurisdiction of a state for tax purposes, was based on, you know, the fact that Amazon put your FBA inventory in that state, oftentimes without sellers really knowing. At that time, it wasn't easy to find out back in the day where your stuff was going.
Right.
And yeah, just does not constitute nexus under, you know, forgetting tax, just the most basic principles of due process, which is like, can you be sued? You know, could I be sued in Alaska if my inventory ends up in a warehouse in Alaska? And the answer is pretty much no. And we know that from the tort context. We know that from other contexts. And so if you don't have nexus on those grounds, then these issues of physical presence and tax don't really come into play, because you need sort of, there's sort of two parts to nexus. And I've gone over this in detail in the past, and I don't want to bore your audience, but, you know, there's basically what we call due process and commerce clause nexus. And, you know, physical presence is based on what we call the commerce clause. It's very unique to tax, but you still need a due process nexus, which is basically the, can I be sued or subject to the jurisdiction of a state? And we don't think FBA amounts to that. So you've got sort of two strong arguments. One is you don't really have nexus. And even if you did, you're still not the store. It's Amazon's store, as Jeff Bezos recently told Congress. So, yeah, so that blog post just kind of suddenly people started reaching out to me left and right. I didn't even have a law firm email account. I mean, people were just emailing me personally and saying, like, hey, you know, you want to, can you help me? And can you do that? You know, and from there, it sort of snowballed into, you know, a law practice of sorts.
Sellers were getting threatening letters, especially I know I got it at the time too from California, basically saying, submit your information and, you know, your sales and, you know, et cetera. And one of the sort of pieces of advice that you had first that I don't know if you officially, maybe because you weren't necessarily acting in sort of everybody's attorney, but one of the pieces of advice that I kind of felt you had at the time was like, ignore this. This will eventually, you know, this will eventually go away. And it seemed like that's actually the sellers who did that benefited, because eventually, you know, states passed laws that said that the marketplace has to collect. So, what's the, and, you know, saving a lot of sellers who didn't, you know, submit their information, a lot of, you know, headache in terms of starting to collect and remit sales tax. So what's the current state of the sales tax issue? Is it still an issue for sellers, or for the most part, is it now all, you know, being collected by, you know, by Amazon and remitting? Like, is there, you know, are there still concerns around this topic in certain states for Amazon?
Yeah,
sellers?
It's sort of both. It's and you're right. I mean, it's a combination of things. I'm happy to give you an update and we'll have some new info on that too. But basically, what happens is California is still actively pursuing the sellers who registered. So you're right. I mean, by ignoring them and you know, sort of what I preach was sort of strategic ignoring. You know, there's certain things you can ignore and there's certain things you can't. Like if you get a tax bill from the state, that can lead to collection. So that's sort of the moment in time where you want to be responsive. But a lot of the letters people were getting, I mean, people got threatened with jail time, which is absolutely nonsense. They were just literally making stuff up as they went just to get people's attention and basically, you know, scare the crap out of them, for lack of a better word, so that they would then register and, you know, subsequent, you know, once you registered, then they would say, you know, we want all the money for your back taxes. You know, we want you to file back to 2012.
Right. On money you never
money you didn't collect. Right. So, you know, California, it was sort of a starting, you know, hey, first we just need you to register and start collecting prospectively. This is, you know, 2017, 2018. Then, you know, as soon as you did that, and then people thought, okay, I would do that. They would listen to, you know, tax software companies who were trying to sell you a service and say, okay, just register. It's what you need to do. And then as soon as you did that, the first thing the states would say is, oh, great, thanks for registering. Now you need to file all these back here. So we still have a number of cases outstanding with California, regarding people who did register and unfortunately just couldn't, you know, break free of the situation. You know, people who just kind of never responded to the nasty letters, people who never registered in California are certainly doing better and sitting better than those who did. So that, you know, for a lot of people who only sell on Amazon, that's a, you know, it's kind of moving away. Where we're still seeing the sales tax issue is, you know, we do have to address California, and to some extent Washington as well, because they've done that as well. But for the most part, the states, I think, recognize that it's just, you know, it's too much work and not enough payoff to go after, you know, 2 million sellers, over half of whom are in China, for back taxes. But so we do need to address California. And we did. We filed a lawsuit last year to sue the state of California for failing to collect tax from Amazon. So basically saying, you know, Amazon owes the tax and the state was basically derelict and failing to do that. We're currently going through that case very slowly. It's not moving as quickly as I would like, but that's just the nature of lawsuits. But we do have something in the pipeline to bring relief for those people who are still fighting California. But before I get into that, I will say the other issue that's affecting the Amazon community right now in the tax world is, you know, obviously now that Amazon and eBay and Walmart are collecting tax in most states, with Florida being kind of the one notable exception, Missouri being another, but Florida obviously being most sellers, second largest state, is pretty significant. The other issue is that a lot of sellers, you know, are recognizing that if they want to branch out and build their own brand on Shopify or whatever website, right, you know, on their own site, they want their own customers, right? They're recognizing, like, wow, that involves a ton of work. That's, you know, companies have spent over six figures in implementing sales tax systems to address those things. And it's a disaster. So what's happening is a lot of Amazon sellers are now, you know, if they have a Shopify site, they'll refer their sales to Amazon so that Amazon will process the sale and collect the tax. And they're sort of missing out on their opportunity to have their own customer, their own mailing list. You know, they're missing out on all those opportunities. And so now Amazon, where they use sales tax to their advantage in the past to sort of say, hey, you know, here's a way for customers to avoid tax. Now they're using it as a way to keep sellers stuck in the platform to say, hey, you don't want to go to Shopify. Because if you do and you start to do really well and you're like a $3 or $4 million Shopify seller, you're going to have this miserable problem of having to collect tax in 50 states. And so that's an issue we're challenging, you know, proactively. We were right before COVID happened. We were, you know, down in DC and arranged for testimony before the House subcommittee on small business and trying to push that issue that there needs to be sales tax reform so that people can have their own website, so that entrepreneurs aren't basically, you know, priced out of startup because, you know, the moment they have any modicum of success, they've got this massive tax compliance problem. You know, it's not even the tax itself. It's the compliance cost of being registered in 50 states, which we think is ridiculous. Why do you need to register in 50 states just to report a tax? It should be really register in one state or one central clearinghouse and that's it. And we think that, you know, the way forward is to address that and sort of say, hey, you know, with today's technology, there's no excuse for this. This should be really easy. It should be the state's burden to make it easy. And if they can't, then they don't get to participate in this interstate, you know, e-commerce world. Right. So that's the issue. And then to California, I actually have, you know, following up from price gouging, which is being appealed. And we'll get into that a little more if you want, but we do have a lawsuit in the works to address more proactively and quickly. I'm really liking the way, you know, the law on Amazon is developing. You know, price gouging was sort of a test for me to see how the courts would react to the sort of Amazon versus seller dichotomy. I thought it went really well and gave me confidence that, you know, we can bring a case to challenge sort of the due process problem of, you know, somebody in New York sitting at a kitchen table being told that they have to pay years of back taxes in California. So that case is coming probably within the next month. Like, I mean, I plan to file, you know, I was hoping to file in August, but I'm hoping, September. And that's going to be injunctive relief. That's going to move quick. That's not going to be years. That's going to be, you know, months to get it, to get, you know, an answer as to, you know, am I right? Is this unconstitutional from the start? Mm-hmm. Forgetting whether or not Amazon's a retailer, is it even constitutional for these states to assert their nexus over you via FBA? You know, that question we're going to be bringing to the forefront very soon. And I'm excited about that. So if you're still worried about California, if you're one of those people out there who's dealing with California, if you paid California, there may be an opportunity, you know, here to get some money back, even because of the nature of the claim being unconstitutional. So we're working on it. So that's kind of what's going on in sales tax land.
Got it. Got it. And what would you say, you know, today, like, you know, 2020, what are the biggest, like, legal issues that are affecting sellers, you know, that's on Amazon?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting legal issues that pop up. I mean, I think there's always the issues of state laws, right, in how they can apply to an interstate, you know, market, right? I mean, that you know, when we look at the control we have on Amazon and can a state law really be applicable? So what we saw, for example, with price gouging, and the reason why price gouging was so interesting is, again, it was testing a theory of interstate commerce that I've had for a while. I teach in my class in New York, and I teach a law class on, you know, about, you know, how do you really apply one state's law to Amazon when you don't really have the control to do it? So, you know, right. Prop 65 in California is a perfect example. There's now a Prop 65 tool in Amazon, but I mean, can they really, really enforce it against the individual seller? Versus Amazon itself, you know, they can certainly work with Amazon to make Prop 65 compliance required, but can they really punish an Amazon seller who's sitting in another state, may not even be subject to the jurisdiction of California, as we talked about just a moment ago. So Prop 65, as you know, is the environmental compliance rule. It says basically everything, you know, everything will cause cancer, no matter, you know, you pretty much have slapped the sticker on everything you see in California. If you rent a car, you'll see it on the glove box. It's like a little, you know, warning that it says, you know, that this has chemicals that will make you sick. And so how do you comply with that? And,
I mean, can a seller control if their product is sold in a particular state? I was under the impression they can't.
That's the point. Exactly. They can. And that's why, you know, when we brought this case and we challenged the price gouging laws, that was kind of the point. It's kind of like, well, we don't really have the ability to control what state we sell in and out of. So, you know, if Kentucky or Florida or whoever says this is price gouging, right? Well, my only option here is to either, you know, stop selling completely or let this particular state's law control how I sell in all 50 states, which is illegal. And we call it extraterritorial because the state's law is having basically an interstate commerce effect. It's going beyond its borders. And it's also, you know, when you look at the fact that every state has their sort of their own take on price gouging, it's also impossible to comply with every single one. You would basically, the most restricted state would win. So, you know, whoever's the most restrictive price gouging law would basically be rule of the day. It's that issue in price gouging, was really about not just the fact that, you know, we think the states were, you know, deliberately and intentionally trying to avoid conflict with Amazon for their own political reasons. You know, Amazon's responsible for a lot of jobs in the state, but it was also about really just kind of testing that theory that, hey, look, you guys need to work it out with Amazon. You know, if you want price gouging to be enforced, then make Amazon, you know, enact clear guidance, you know, tell Amazon and make them accountable for it, you know?
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. What is actually considered price gouging, and does it apply? I mean, does it apply to only a certain set of like essential products? I know there was this case also of a seller that had bought a lot of hand sanitizer and all these products, just as COVID hit from retail and sold that on Amazon, you know, obviously for a higher price, and ended up getting into this, doing a New York Times interview or something. And that resulted in like the attorney general of, I think, Tennessee, mm-hmm. it was, or something, going after him. What is price gouging like by definition? And, you know, does it apply to any product, or does it apply to only a specific product? And like, yeah, are there like specific guidelines, or what do sellers need to watch out for in terms of trying to, you know, not get caught up in this?
Well, that's just it. And that's part of the problem, is there was no guidelines. You know, some of these states have rules that say, you know, if the governor declares a state of emergency, then anything, you know, related to that emergency, basically, you know, and there's sometimes a list that they'll publish, you know, are subject to price gouging laws. So Florida will say, you know, hey, the governor declared an emergency on March 8th. Anything you sold on or after March 8th that's more than, you know, 10% above what, you know, it previously cost would be considered price gouging. And they would say it's masks, it's, you know, sanitizer, it's paper towels or toilet paper. Mm-hmm. You know, they might designate certain things. What was happening in a lot of cases, though, especially like, you know, people who were selling, you know, getting in trouble with the states, is that, you know, the states, that wasn't enough, because actually by March, by the time the governors were declaring states of emergency, most of the Amazon accounts were being shut down. They were being suspended anyway. So mm-hmm. what the states were then doing is saying, okay, well, what other laws do we have on our book to punish somebody for what we think is immoral behavior? And so they started saying, okay, well, you know, so, you know, when I was handling these cases on the government side, and I had, you know, multiple states subpoenas and investigated demand requests on, you know, you would find that some of these states didn't even have a clear price gouging law like Florida, and would say that, you know, the fact that you were selling hand sanitizer in January is, you know, basically a form of the deceptive practice. It violates their consumer protection laws. And that's where I really started to get really concerned about this, because it sort of sounded like you didn't need a state of emergency at all. You didn't need any type of, you know, list of products. And a lot of them would say that we don't have a list, but we just think, you know, it's kind of like they were trying to make the argument, we know it when we see it. And one of the conversations mm-hmm. we had with Kentucky's AG was, he said, okay, I was on the phone with a seller, and the AG with Gary Ray was on the phone, and another mm-hmm. seller. You know, the question was asked, I think, by the other seller who was on the phone with us, you know, is peanut butter price gouging subject to price gouging? Is McCormick steak seasoning subject to price gouging? And their answer was, we think peanut butter is price gouging. We think McCormick steak seasoning is not. And it's just, that's how arbitrary. So how do you comply with the law? First of all, it's like, it's not even clear, right? They're trying to sort of invoke right. these old laws. So, you know, the message on price gouging is a couple of things. You know, one is there's no federal price gouging law for across the board. There is an executive order in effect right now that does affect masks and hand sanitizer. So I would stay away from those products. And that's limited to those products. But that's federal. So, you know, you've got this federal law that's been invoked. And so you have to be mindful of that now in the price gouging space. And there's some issues there too. We've had to deal with FBI interviews. It's concerning about that. But, you know, as far as the states, I mean, I think what our, you know, federal court case in Kentucky, and it's currently going up before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal, what that is really to say, look, you really can't enforce price gouging at the state level. Like, you just can't do it, at least against the Amazon sellers. Now, if you have a price gouging policy that you want implemented, you're going to have to push that through Amazon directly, and then Amazon's going to have to make that clear. Now, of course, Amazon might also have their own challenge to say that some of that's unconstitutional because it's not clear, or it's ambiguous. But that's Amazon's problem. The point is, you really can't go after the seller. So I think with our case, I feel good that sellers are protected. I mean, I think the constitutional law was sort of obvious why we wanted to bring the case. You know, to say that, you know, really sellers should be protected in going about their business and selling retail arbitrage, whatever they want, with the exception of, you know, mass hand sanitizer, PPE, COVID items, you know, that you've got to be mindful of, because there's this federal law that's now been kicked in. But, you know, as far as peanut butter and, you know, anything else, video games, I mean, the people were concerned video games might be considered price gouging in some because they were saying, you know, people are stuck at home, and so it's becoming an essential item to keep the kids engaged. You got to sell video games. And so we were seeing all sorts of crazy stuff. So, I mean, I think at the base level, I think Amazon sellers, I think thanks to the case we brought and that we'll continue to defend and appeal and push forward, you know, I think sellers are protected from the state price gouging laws. And then, you know, so I think sellers should feel comfortable that they can continue to sell, because that was scary to me. You know, I still arbitrage. I still have things I bought at Walmart for $2 and I've sold for 50. I mean, is that price gouging? It's, you know, it's a huge multiple of what I paid for it. You know, I wanted to make sure that, like, it was clear how this law is going to work, and that, you know, and there was a number of other challenges that we raised in our case that the court didn't even have to consider and didn't consider, because our basic constitutional law question of how can you impose this law on an Amazon seller who has no control over what state they sell into, is pretty much what got the judge's attention. And the judge was pretty, very clear and very detailed in making his decision. It's a very well-written opinion, by a judge that really understands the constitutional law components of what we're dealing with, and sort of saying, yeah, you really can't. You know, these state laws really, really become unduly burdensome on the interstate marketplace when you're trying to apply them on to somebody who's really selling not just in Kentucky, but in all 50 states, and without sort of the ability to control that state. So I feel good about price gouging, that we're where we need to be on that, and we'll continue to press on with that issue.
And there are specific, like, for PPE products for people who are selling. We, you know, I have several clients that we run ads for that are doing the hand sanitizer and masks and, you know, PPE type products. There are federal guidelines as to the profit margin that you can charge on those products.
There are no guidelines, unfortunately, but what there are is, it's a federal law that basically, and I'll pull it up. It's 50 USC 4512, and it was the executive order. If you Google, you know, the executive order invoking the law, but basically saying that, you know, you can't price gouge on, you know, PPE products such as hand sanitizers and masks. Now, where I've been told, and this is scary. This raises another issue, because I've had this conversation with FBI agents who've investigated clients. It's really a little scary right now. But what one U.S. attorney told me in our discussion is that if you sell a PPE product at any multiple over pre-COVID, so, you know, if you're used to paying $1 for a mask and now you're selling it for more than two, that's a multiple, right? That's basically right. So anything over any multiples, so more than one, basically more than double, in their mind, it was price gouging. But here's where it got scary. Usually in price gouging, you have a defense that says, you know, if my costs go up, right, my costs are higher, then I'm not price gouging. I'm just, you know, this is the market. Their response to that was, no, you don't get that excuse. You don't get that defense.
I have clients that, you know, were buying like forehead, you know, touchless thermometers and stuff for $8. And their Chinese suppliers raised them to 20, you know, during the pandemic.
Yeah, and I don't know if the thermometers, they may actually be in the executive order, but I think they are actually. But yeah, for example, the masks, you know, I was saying, well, you know, these days some people are paying, you know, three or four times the multiple just to get them out of China. And they say, well, we think that's the problem. You see, the way they saw it is that by sort of participating in the market and creating, you're sort of creating the market. You're creating the rabid demand that's causing the multiple to be so high. And so basically what they were saying is, we're not going to excuse you as the U.S. Attorney's Office. We think the way the law is meant to be interpreted is you're not going to be excused from what you're doing just because of the fact that your manufacturer in China raised the price. And they're very focused on China. So, you know, you think about the Trump administration, you think about what's going on.
Right.
It started to sound like some sort of 3M, you know, protection conspiracy here. I mean, it was really a little weird the way that conversation went. They're like, yeah, no, the fact that you paid $4 or for a mask or $2 or $3 for a mask in China doesn't excuse you, because by doing that, you've created, you know, the pandemonium that causes the price hike, the gouging. So that was their position, which I think that, you know, if we actually see a case come out of this where that's the government's position, then, you know, we'll have to address it at time. I mean, that's, but that is their position. So anyone who may have actually spoken to the U.S. Attorney's office, and maybe in different states, they've taken a different position. But in the one state that I dealt with a U.S. attorney directly, because, you know, the FBI agent just finally said, fine, why don't you talk to the U.S. attorney and put me in contact. That was, my understanding is that was their position, is that, you know, there's no defense, that my cost was up because that's how much China charged me.
Which is ridiculous, because I know one of the things early on that happened because of the fear around price gouging is just PPE products just didn't get to the U.S., right? They all went to Europe or other places where, you know, they didn't have this because of the fear of, you know, resellers, you know, and then a lack of actual lack of supply in the marketplace because of, you know, fear of price gouging.
Exactly. I mean, it's really counterintuitive to do that. You know, price gouging laws are concerning. I mean, I get it. Like, I mean, price gouging laws, like especially state price gouging laws. And one thing we were clear about in our case, like, we're not trying to take the state's right to regulate price gouging away. In fact, that we were very sort of surgical in the way we carved out what we were arguing so that, you know, we could defend the seller, but without sort of, you know, making sort of a, what I call sort of a libertarian style claim against all price gouging laws, right? And, you know, there's something to be said. You know, I've lived in Florida. You know, I've been through a hurricane where no power for weeks. It's a miserable experience. You know, last thing I want to do is walk, you know, around the corner to the 7-Eleven and have to pay, you know, $50 for a bottle of water. And, you know, if I, my house is blown down, I have to pay, you know, $10,000 to stay at the Holiday Inn. That's normally $70. You know, I get, you know, price gouging laws have a place. But, you know, when sort of imposed improperly, they do, they can have really negative effects in the market. And I think that's probably, you know, to some extent what the administration wants. I mean, I think that, you know, the impression I got from the U.S. attorney is that they're sort of, like I said, I mean, it started to sound like a conspiracy to sort of, you know, keep people buying American, right? Like, they didn't want you buying the China masks. They wanted you buying the 3M masks that were being made here. And that was the idea, or supporting an American company that was, because I know 3M also makes a lot of masks in China too.
Yeah.
But, you know, the president has just, you know, spent all this effort to get 3M, you know, maximizing their mask output. They changed the law to make N95s officially medical devices. They weren't originally medical devices pre-COVID, which is another thing about this whole price gouging thing that was really obnoxious, is that at the time, a lot of our members were arbitraging the masks. They weren't even considered medical devices. You know, they weren't allowed to be sold as medical. They were construction, for construction equipment. And so, you know, this was, you know, them being punished for not having foresight, or attempting to punish them for not having foresight that nobody had, you know.
Right.
You know, so it felt strange. It felt like a strange conversation I had with that I remember that with the U.S. attorney.
Yes.
when she said you couldn't, you know, use your increased costs as a defense, which is always in any price gouging case, when you're in the merits, that's always going to be your defense. Is you're going to lay out your costs and say, you know, this is how much it cost me, so this is why my price was higher. That's usually the first line of defense,
right,
in a price gouging case, other than, you know, the constitutional issues we raised, which was a different approach.
So and it seems like, you know, so far you've had success in sort of beating that sort of law that Amazon sellers need to, you know, that it's impossible for them to comply with, you know, every state price gouging laws, and, you know, won the case in Kentucky, and that's a great win on behalf of Amazon sellers. I want to jump, Paul, to talking about a change Amazon is making in September. They're going to start putting your address publicly available. They already do this in Mexico, and I think some other marketplaces where your address is publicly available for, you know, the public to click on your seller name and see your address. Do you think that, one, you know, should sellers start, you know, getting virtual addresses? And, you know, a lot of sellers have their home address, you know, on their, under their business. And also should, you know, do you think this will enable some legal battles to happen that maybe, or some bullying to happen that maybe doesn't happen as much now? So my thought is maybe, you know, our retail arbitrage or reseller, you know, is on a listing, Now, big brand has easily accessible their name and address, and they send them threatening legal letters, telling them they're not authorized sellers. And, you know, we know we have the first sale doctrine. And, you know, do you think this is going to lead to sort of additional headaches for sellers?
Yeah, I do. I'm still trying to get my head around exactly what the motivation is here. You know, there's concern that this is really, you know, is this about, you know, for example, the fact that California is promoting a law that says that, you know, Amazon should be liable for personal injury cases, which has been an issue that's been going on in the courts for years and still not resolved. Is it about trying to make to now that, you know, they're trying to sort of make the identity of the seller more knowable in a sense that they can say, okay, so they really are the seller. You know, again, Amazon's very two-faced, right? Because in the antitrust context, they like to make it clear it's their store. It's their store, you know, which is the exact opposite of what they argue in like sales tax, price gouging, infringement, and of course, you know, personal injury cases, right? It's not our store. We're just a flea market. So they speak out of both sides of their mouth, and it's quite frustrating because it's legally, it's nonsense. So is that what this is about?
Yeah. What's the benefit to Amazon to put this out there as far as who the seller and their address is? Like, why would Amazon be, you know, trying to understand what's the motivation of why Amazon is, you know, is doing this?
I'm still not sure. I mean, I because there's sort of two things going on. There's on the front end, there's the disclosure, and on the back end, there's more strict sort of identity verification procedures. Now, the more strict identity verification procedures, my take is it's probably anti-money laundering related, that they're finally people are figuring out that, boy, if I want to launder a ton of money, you know, across the world, I can use Amazon, and it's so easy to manipulate, and it's pretty much untraceable the way it's set up. So by putting, you know, real human beings behind each, you know, each listing, it sort of limits the ability for, you know, people to cheat or misuse the platform, as you call it, for those ways. But then sort of what's the reason for fully disclosing? That I'm not so sure. It may be customer demand. Maybe customers, you know, listen, with the Wall Street Journal and you know, reporting on, you know, sellers in China using, chemicals in their products that are dangerous. You know, maybe people want to know if their products are really, you know, from people in the U.S. where you're more likely to care about personal injury laws and being sued versus China where you could care less. Like, you have no incentive, right? I mean, if you can save 5 cents by using lead paint in China, you're going to use lead paint if you're purely profit motivated, right? I mean, that's the problem. That's why we're seeing such a flood of garbage products coming through. Products that can catch on fire, because none of those standards matter when you're unreachable from lawsuit, right? Well, the legal system, you know, as much as we love and hate it, or mostly hate it, does serve a purpose in that, you know, it reinforces good behavior, right? I mean, without legal consequences to bad actions, companies wouldn't necessarily do the right thing. So that's why the system works. But when you remove half of Amazon sellers from those legal consequences, you start to see what happens, and you know, products you would never find on the store shelves of a Target or a Home Depot, you suddenly find on Amazon, and there's a good reason why they're not in those stores, but, you know, Amazon takes no accountability. So is this a way for Amazon to sort of, you know, one, let the public kind of know, okay, this is what you're buying? I think there is concern that the laws have shifted. Not really the laws have shifted, but just more, you know, the bench is sort of, the judges and whatnot have sort of kind of gotten wise to the Amazon is just a marketplace nonsense and starting to see through it. And so this is a way of saying, hey, we make it clear who the seller is. We give the person their address. They can see. So I have, you know, a belief that has
Amazon
to do with
to,
that.
Amazon trying to make sure or to say, hey, you know, this is all available to you. Like the seller is responsible for the liability.
Right. It's kind of like in sales tax, when we would say, like, look, we don't even have a customer, right? You know, we're not the store. It's like, we don't, you know, customers don't even know who we are, right? We're just some username, right? It's not really, you know, it's not the same as being a retailer in the Mall of America where, you know, this is sort of Amazon's way to, like, sort of, they're not going to give you the customer, but they're going to give the customer you. So the customer knows that, you know, they're not buying from Amazon, they're buying from so-and-so LLC. At least that's what they're trying to make. That's what they're trying to position themselves as doing. So they can say that way, if somebody sues them, they get injured, they say, hey, no. You says right there, you bought from so-and-so LLC and, you know,
right.
123 Main Street. You know, I have a feeling it has something to do with that. I mean, we're still trying to figure out what the motivation was for doing that. But I think it has something to do with, you know, sort of the change in what legal liability theory that has sort of shifted towards, you know, Amazon being liable as a store. It may also be related to the antitrust hearing and sort of, you know, trying to right. make it seem like Amazon's suppressing the sellers. But again, I mean, without giving access to the customer, I'm not sure that solves it. But what I've seen in the personal injury space where the courts are and, you know, sort of the way Amazon's handling it, I think it has something to do with, you know, so that when the next personal injury lawsuit comes around, Amazon can say, hey, you bought from so-and-so LLC.
Right. It's a lot clearer.
Right. I still think they lose, but, right. you know, it's sort of, you know, until they full on give you the customer like Shopify or, you know, Facebook, you know, I think they lose, but,
right.
You know,
which I don't think Amazon will ever do.
No, I think they're just going to, you know, exactly. They're not going to do that. So they're going to try to, you know, but that's their game. They're always kind of one step ahead, trying to be sneaky in ways of, you know, trying to skirt the law. Cause I mean, it's sort of what they do. I mean, that their business model a lot is based on taking, you know, legal risks that normal stores wouldn't take. And then the way they justify it is by trying to change the way the law is interpreted, saying, hey, we're not responsible right. for this if it catches on fire. We're not responsible if somebody steals your trademark or patent. You know, that's on just between you and them. We're just a flea market. So, right. you know, it doesn't really fit the facts. Like the facts don't really match the description. So they're trying to make the facts match the description a little bit more, but not enough.
Do you think, you know, talking a little bit about antitrust, do you think the way the current antitrust laws are set up, they're kind of set up for Amazon to be able to operate the way they operate. Do you think anything will sort of come out of these legal hearings? Do you think Amazon, you know, that there'll be some kind of like that Amazon will get broken up, like AWS and retail and marketplace will need to become separate businesses without being able to kind of like, you know, Amazon says that, you know, they asked Jeff Bezos and Congress if, you know, Amazon used third-party seller data to launch their own private label products. And, you know, he said, you know, he basically said it's against our policy, but I can't guarantee that, you know, that hasn't happened. I mean, what do you think comes out? Do you think this is just a show or do you think something concrete will come out of this government investigation into like antitrust of, you know, Amazon?
That's a great question. And, you know, I did on behalf of the Online Merchants Guild, which as you mentioned, it's applying for nonprofit status, still waiting to hear back from the IRS. But it's a trade association. It's designed for Amazon sellers to join so that we can, you know, put money together and advocate. If you go on the website for the antitrust committee, you'll see our testimony. We submitted written testimony to the committee, expressing our concerns, based on kind of compiling what we've heard from our members and from the community. And, you know, I think there's a couple of things going on. I mean, obviously Jeff Bezos is going to say, I didn't know, right? I mean, he's the CEO of a massive company. He can't be involved in every misdeed.
Right.
So, you know, somebody broke the wall and did what they shouldn't have done. You know, I'll look into it. You know, that's unacceptable. You know, they'll fire somebody.
Right.
You know, I do worry that the competing against seller thing, you know, I do worry that it's kind of a red herring in that, you know, it does happen. We know it happens. We've heard about it. We've heard about it from people who've happened to. Is it the biggest part of Amazon's business, their private label? I mean, their biggest private label brand, as far as I know, is batteries by a long shot. It's really, is this really what they're doing to sort of dominate? Is this where, you know, I kind of worry that Amazon almost likes the fact that this is where the attention is because it sounds, while it sounds awful, it's not really that, you know, major of an issue. It's one that can be easily patched, probably doesn't warrant a breakup of any kind, maybe some fines.
Right.
And, but
they're making a lot more money off marketplace.
Exactly. And that's the monopoly that I'm concerned about. So, you know, we address it. I don't particularly prioritize it. I worry that Congress does, because it just, again, this, when you, the story is, when it happens to you, it sucks. And I feel bad for the people who happens to, but it's not happening on a massive scale. Right. And it's not contributing to a tremendous amount of their bottom line. It's really, you know, their sort of ruthless control over the market as a whole that I'm concerned about. You know, the fact that they are the railroad of e-commerce. I was welcoming, which is what we've been saying for years, I've been welcoming that sort of, now I hear it said more and more, the guy from NYU says it, I hear Congress saying it, you know, the railroad of e-commerce. And to me, that's the problem, is that they're the railroad and they're the store. So the analogy, and we use this, I've been using for a while, and the analogy we use in our letter is sort of like, you know, if you could imagine Henry Ford back in the day, right, going around to different states and saying, hey, we're going to build this thing called a highway in your state. You're going to help us pay for it. You're going to divert a lot of tax money, help us pay for it. And when it's all said and done, it's going to have a lot of jobs. It's going to be great for the economy. You're going to love it. But we're going to own it. You're not going to own it. We own it. We, Amazon, or Henry Ford, Ford Motor Company, own it. So only Ford drivers get to use this awesome highway. Chevy drivers, you got to take the back roads, right? What happens to Chevy? What happens to Chrysler? What happens to, right? If your car doesn't come with access to the highway, you lose out. And I think that's the problem. I think that Amazon has built an amazing e-commerce superhighway. They've also built an attentive audience through Prime, with you know, over 100 million users, 70% of households. And the question is, how do you get those Prime members to kind of look outside of Amazon? How do you kind of divert their attention? And what I've suggested, and this may seem extreme, but is that you take Prime as a, you know, the delivery network, the subscription, not the movies. I don't care about the movies and the music and the books. I'm talking about the delivery network that is FBA, and you basically open that up almost like a quasi-public utility, or just as a spin-off of as sort of a separate private company that, you know, is open to anyone. That, you know, if you're a small business website, you can sell your Shopify products, kind of like what Shopify is trying to do right now anyway, but you can sell it Prime. You can sell, if you're Bloomingdale's, you can use Prime. And if not the delivery network itself, then just that membership, that sign-on, that, you know, I can log in with Prime and get Prime delivery on other websites. And you sort of say, okay, Prime is really the railroad. Prime and the delivery network, that's the road. Take the railroad out of Amazon's control. Open the railroad up to everybody to use, so that, you know, and they've had this sort of massive, attentive user base. And let Prime members log in with their Prime credentials to Macy's or Walmart or whoever, and then get the Prime delivery and try to, I think that's how you cure the problem here, because it's definitely, Amazon has a dominant problem here. That's one thing. One thing I've talked to committee members about is, you know, whether, you know, Amazon, you know, we've talked about how Amazon is so restrictive about, like, you know, their customer, and that, you know, while, you know, Samsung obviously is a big enough company that they can put a warranty card and the catalog in their box with their products and saying, you know, buy from us directly. Small sellers can get into major trouble for doing that. And so, you know, while, you know, I've been asked sort of, well, should Amazon make their customer list available to every user? I said, well, obviously we'd like that. I mean, I could see the counter argument to that being that, you know, I don't think every customer of Amazon wants to get an email, you know, from every user for every time they buy something from a seller. I think that would be probably something the customer wouldn't want. But at the same time, there's probably a happy medium, like allowing the customer to promote their own website in the box, on the box. Like, that stuff shouldn't be restricted. I should be allowed to put my warranty card or my catalog or my, you know, here's a coupon to buy direct from my website next time in the box, just as you can in any store, right? Like, when you buy something at Walmart, there's always like, oh, well, next time buy direct on Nintendo.com and save 10% or something. You know, we should be allowed some level of access to solicit our customers, and in order to sort of break away from Amazon. So that's kind of how I see it. I would like to see that addressed, though, because I think, you know, Amazon's control over the railroad gives them the ability to dictate the terms. And fortunately, that's how they mistreat the sellers. It's also an unusual antitrust case, because really everything Amazon does, you know, I sort of liken Amazon to Costco. And so, you know, really what Amazon's business model, it's domination, and the way they sort of earn their monopoly, you know, rewards is through the Prime membership, through that loyalty, by making Prime seem like it's almost like required in life to have. and right. keeping people in prime. That's why they're so protective about lower prices on eBay. They always want to be, you know, they're all about protecting prime. What happens on Prime, though, the reason why, for example, why is your data so available so that, like, there's software out there, you know, I launch a product and immediately, you know, thousands of people can log on to this computer software and see that I'm doing really well and then pile in, right? Why is that mm-hmm. done? Because Amazon likes to encourage competition within Amazon right. because that drives prices down. And right. that makes customers feel like they're getting a better deal. They're always going to be doing what they can to drive prices down. So it's kind of hard to argue for an antitrust. It's hard to make an antitrust argument when the consumer is benefiting from, you know, price competition. But where the sort of the monopoly happens is sort of at one level above. It's, you know, they have to be in this sort of prime, you know, getting them into this prime thing and getting them hooked into Amazon. That's what Amazon's focused on. They sort of borrow the Costco model that Prime is sort of a necessity in life. And when you're a Prime member, you get all these, you know, benefits and access to things that are super valuable. And so that's where it happens. And that a lot of what Amazon does to dominate is through its treatment of the sellers, you know, through the, you know, it makes more money on the sellers than a typical retailer would make selling those same products. So it sort of, you know, is able to leverage better terms than in a typical retail transaction, you know, like better than, like, say, Walmart could get against, you know, Apple, because it's got this whole network of independent small businesses that it can just take advantage of and get away with 45% commissions or, you know, fees between FBA and referral right. fees. So it's a different kind of monopoly than we've seen in the past, but in some ways it's like the old railroads. And I hope Congress does something. You know, I'm not confident in Congress's ability to do anything right now. I'm glad that they're looking into it. I was glad to hear during the hearing that, you know, some Congress people were starting to get it and see that things were, you know, I started to hear things. I'm like, okay, you're actually starting to get this. They've got great, competent people on staff who get it, but, you know, what comes out of it, I don't know. But I mean, as far as breaking up AWS and Amazon, I don't think that's the right answer, because I'm not sure that's where, you know,
the difference.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing with AWS is that they probably, you know, funded their losses with AWS, right? AWS right. was, you know, as a standalone was probably much more profitable over the right. years. So when Amazon was showing losses because they couldn't
right.
actually afford. Yeah,
now it's too late.
Yeah, now it's too late. So what are you going to do? Right. But really the two are, yeah, that ship has sailed. So, I mean, it's not really. Right.
But giving Prime sort of universal access would take away the tremendous competitive advantage.
That, I think it would. I think it would Amazon help. Has. It would help redistribute people's attention to other websites and make them feel right. like they can shop elsewhere and you know, recognize that, you know, they kind of achieved Prime through a lot of unnatural ways. Like sales tax was a big part. You know, if you live in a state and you know, if you were a Prime member in 2010, you know, and you were in one of the many states where Amazon didn't collect sales tax, look, you spend $1,000 a year on Amazon and the sales tax you save will pay for your Prime membership. I mean, it was right. an obvious arbitrage to just be a Prime member and buy on Amazon
right.
back then with the sales tax advantages they had, plus all the incentives they received to build out that network. I mean, the government,
yes.
the state government's paid for so much of it. I feel like that's kind of why I say public utility or quasi-public utility, because I feel like the government paid for it. I feel like we should have some ownership of it. I wrote this in CNN. They sort of took my concept and put the title Prime should be free in the editorial I wrote, which is kind of misrepresents what I'm saying. I'm not saying it should right. be free. I'm just saying it should be free to use for other businesses that they've got this sort of inorganic right. growth.
That and Prime it's going to be its own entity, its own separate company, not tied to one specific e-commerce website.
Right. If you want to take the dominance away, that's how you do it. So whether Congress will agree with me or whether, you know, we'll see any action out of it is another story. But I think that would be useful, and I think it would be helpful for, you know, people want to start their own Shopify business, if they could say, hey, like, you can log in by registering or you can just use your Prime membership. And, you know, here's the Prime member benefits you get when you buy on our website.
Right.
You know, you get we'll ship to you in 2 days or whatever.
Right. Makes sense. Paul, I want to jump to end off talking a little bit about what you and Jeff Shake are doing with Seller Basics. I know that's kind of like a service that you guys created to help sellers navigate through a lot of the legal issues. So can you talk a little bit about that service, what the offering is, and you know how it might help sellers instead of paying thousands of dollars to solve an issue to kind of reduce that?
Yeah, Amazon is selling online. It's a legal minefield. Like every day, it's something else. It's class action lawsuit. It's price gouging from the states. Tax assessments. And of course, suspensions and IP complaints, like you said, with the first sale doctrine versus, the right to quality control, which is an unsettled issue, right? People, it's impossible to keep up with all the issues that just keep popping up on Amazon. And those are just kind of the main ones. There's always quirky stuff that comes up. And, one of the things we notice as lawyers is, lawyers have a reputation for being expensive. And a lot of times people miss out on the opportunity to get, really good advice at a critical moment. Sometimes a 15-minute phone call, at the right moment would have saved our client, a lot of headache and aggravation. Mm-hmm. So, as a law firm that's sort of a full service Amazon firm, and we do everything that Amazon sellers need, right? Whether it's product recalls, whether it's suspensions, whether it's, selling your business, obviously tax is where we started from. Jeff Schick and myself have sort of, built a strong practice and just sort of being Amazon focused and understanding how, none of the stuff sellers deal with in its own right is particularly complex as a small business. But when you add in the layer of complexity of being multi-state, multinational businesses out of your house or out of a small, small location with just a few people, it's a game changer. And so I have a corporate law background working for huge corporations, and I'm sort of taking that and trying to bring that and make it accessible for small businesses on Amazon. Jeff, like me in law school, was a seller, except he's a seven-figure seller. He still is. And I encourage him to keep that business because it keeps him in the game. He knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. He's constantly up. And so that's why he leads our suspension practice. And so what Seller Basics does is basically it's a $99 a month program that we created that says, look, you need to call an attorney. Like if something happens or if you have a question or you just want to know if your LLC is done right, whatever it is, 15-minute call anytime, no problem. $99 a month, right? Sellerbasics.com. In addition to that, as a member, we're going to discount our offerings to you. So for example, instead of, spending thousands, I think I have so many clients who are spending like $5,000 when they were getting suspended for price gouging with some of these other consultants. We're charging $750 for mm-hmm. a full account suspension. If you get a letter from a brand and you need to respond and you need us to try to retract, get them to retract, we'd charge $149, right? Because we realized like at the old pricing model, like we couldn't, it wasn't economical for us to handle every IP suspension at $149. So what we figured out is this is kind of a sort of like an insurance style benefit where like everybody subscribes and then when people need us, we can do things at discounted cost for them because not everyone's going to need us at the same time. Right. And there's these other benefits. So we've brought down the cost. We actually have this thing called vanishing deductible, kind of like borrowing from Allstate, where if you're a member for a year, so you spend $99 a month for a year, your next suspension is actually free. It's not even, as long as you keep your membership, your next suspension is actually covered. We don't even charge you the $750. And we're trying to kind of develop more incentives, but the program's done really well. We've been a little overwhelmed. We've just hired on a new attorney, recently, and she's helping us, keep pace, but, we've been really overwhelmed with the success, especially since we launched right around COVID. And, like I said, normally what we do is, so people don't just add and drop. Obviously there's sort of a, it's more, if you join, and when you're suspended, then there's sort of a pre-existing, fee that goes along with that suspension. We were waiving that during COVID because of all the price gouging craziness and just, showing people the value of the membership. Mm-hmm. And it's just been like overwhelmingly successful. And I love it. I wish people would utilize it more. I wish people would call us more and just schedule the 15-minute consults and say, hey, why don't you tell me something about, what do you know about asset protection? Is the LLC I formed on LegalZoom 10 years ago, is that operating agreement still good? Is that what I should have now that I'm worth seven figures and I have two businesses on Amazon? And, the short answer is no, but, those are good questions to ask. And it's great for newer sellers who are trying to figure things out. Don't blog posts aren't lawyers. There's a lot of non-lawyers sort of, posing that they can do things that are really legal issues. Like IP infringement cases are legal issues. The first sale doctrine, mm-hmm. while I'm a supporter of the first sale doctrine and I'm strong, there are nuances to it. It's not perfectly clear, right?
Right.
There's some products that do make for a stronger case, and where the case law is on the first sale doctrine is we don't know. It's the courts are sort of saying that there's, you know, in, there are cases where, you know, companies have the right to quality control, and if you're not meeting that, that can infringe on the trademark. This Skullcandy case in Utah is a perfect example of, you know, where the court sort of, you know, inconclusively just, you know, because the way the case was basically a motion to dismiss, basically said, yeah, there are these open questions, they need to be addressed. So, you know, court didn't just say first sale doctrine, no case. They said, no, there's issues. You know, so we always say, like, you know, if you're selling, you know, children's medicine and it's got to be stored at a certain temperature or something like that, like, obviously there's a strong case for quality control. If you're selling vitamins or fish oil and you're storing it in a garage at 200 degrees, or there's the possibility that you are, and so the brand needs to make sure that you're not, so they use authorized, they have a stronger case. If you're selling Ernest Goes to Camp on DVD because you bought 20 copies on clearance, I don't think the Ernest Goes to Camp people have a strong argument to say that there's a warranty issue, right? Because how many people are going to claim an Ernest Goes to Camp warranty? It's probably pretextual. So there's sort of a spectrum with the first sale doctrine. So we run into that a lot. We also run into, sadly, a lot of people are claiming to be diverters and they're just counterfeiters. So people think that they're getting legit diverted goods and they're actually buying counterfeit. And that's really problematic. So, you know, spending a few minutes talking to us ahead of time and having somebody you know you can lean on when you, you know, if you do get suspended, if your account does, or if you get one of these IP complaints, it's $99 a month for the initial, you know, service. And then, you know, like I said, the services are very discounted. And we think it's a value. We're trying to bring, you know, just sound guidance to people who, you know, because in our experience, that's what people were missing early on. So they never got that sound guidance, that 15-minute phone call that could just change the trajectory of things and said, if I only knew that, I would have done it this way. That's the point.
I can be, you know, I can give sort of firsthand testimony to the a lot of really good sound guidance that, you know, you've personally given me, you know, in business that has led me to make better decisions and legal agreements and deals where, you know, it was well worth, you know, having the conversation and getting guidance from, you know, an area where you're not an expert, you know, and relying on other people that are experts that have a good understanding that are looking out for, you know, for your best interest, you know, I think is really, really important in business. So so your websites are Ecom Attorneys. That's kind of your main legal website. And then the service is sellerbasics.com. You know, you offer basically for $99 a month, you get unlimited, you know, these quick consults and then discounts when you do deal with, you know, things like IP claims and any legal issues, suspensions, all these things that, you know, a lot of other service providers are charging, you know, thousands of dollars for, deeply discounted by having this this membership in this site. And like you said, it kind of, it allows you guys to offer discounts because it's like a insurance pool of funds that you're able to get, and not everyone needs you every month. And so that kind of subsidizes maybe somebody else's cost when they do need it. So I think it's a great concept and something people should sign up for. And Paul, what are the best ways for people to, you know, get in touch with you, reach out to you, to, you know, sort of deal with any, you know, e-commerce legal issues that they're having in their business or discuss?
Sure. My email address is paul@ecomattorneys.com. It goes right to me, so you will be emailing me directly. So paul@ecomattorneys.com. And then we have a website, ecomattorneys.com. And there's also, you know, if it's more of a sort of, you know, issue for the seller community at large, you just kind of want to talk or you want to learn about the online merchant skill, which is that, you know, applying for nonprofit, waiting approval from the IRS organization, onlinemerchantskill.org. The website needs work. We need volunteers to help us who have good WordPress skills to make that more jazzy, and some ideas for that. But paul@onlinemerchantskill.org is another way to reach me, and definitely, you know, check out Online Merchant Skill as well, and check out sellerbasics.com and ecomattorneys, ecomattorneys.com for more insight into what we're up to. And yeah, just, you know, we, you know, that's what we're here to do. We're just trying to, you know, it's it's our legal knowledge. And I'll tell you what's really paying off for, you know, for our clients is just the amount of experience we've had over the last few years helping. You know, we've just seen so much. I mean, the craziest stuff I've ever seen in my life is through helping Amazon sell us. It's just some of the craziest things. And we just, you know, and then when they start to repeat, you just realize that, you know, you're glad you've been through the ringer on some of these issues. So, you know, things that you may think are nuts, we've probably already seen it. So, you know, that's, again, another reason to be a member of sellerbasics.com and, have that opportunity for the unlimited, again, unlimited within reason, right? Unlimited is sort of a per issue concept. It's, you know, you can't be like, I'm selling my business and break it up into, you know, 30, 15 minute phone calls. That's not the program. It's meant to be kind of per issue where, you know, you have a curiosity, you have a question, you're expanding your business, you're doing something different. Maybe you got a scary letter. You know, that initial, you know, knowing you have a lawyer to call, that's the point. That you have somebody to call. We're just going to give it to you how it is. I have a hard time sticking to 15 minutes. You tell I like to talk. So, you know, so I think you get extra benefit there when you schedule with me. Definitely check it out.
Excellent. And there's also a Seller Basics Facebook group, you know, you can kind of follow. You know, Paul will post when he's, you know, fighting against, you know, a state or the government on behalf of Amazon sellers and where there's updates. I follow that to kind of see what's happening with, you know, the price gouging and the sales tax and some of these issues that are affecting sellers. So you can join that as well. Paul, thank you so much for coming on and, you know, helping sellers sort of understand what the current legal issues are. You know, what they may be dealing with. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's always great. It's fun to talk about this stuff. I really enjoy doing the work and love to talk about it. And just, you know, like I said, it's I really look forward to the day when we can really get, you know, sellers organized as a community together and really, you know, demonstrate how much power we really have over Amazon or any other company, because there's a lot of us out there. We just need to really kind of learn the lesson that the big corporations learned a long time ago, that, you know, when you have those common interests, we need to get organized and work together.
Absolutely.
So
thank you.
Thanks again, Leron. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Continue the conversation in the Facebook group, e-commerce mindset. This coming Friday, we're going to have a session on listing optimization with Karen Thomas. And you know, within the group, we continue the conversation on what's currently happening in the e-commerce and Amazon seller space. So if you're not in the group, e-commerce mindset, please join. And thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next episode of the podcast.